I think of Olivia. She was my cat. There was no question of my bringing her to Dublin with me when I left. She was a country cat, invigorated by the outdoors. I was in awe of her dub life, hunting and killing in the blackest of nights, and the next day, curled snugly on the sofa, looking pampered as a pasha. Before having her spayed, we had allowed her, one time, to go into heat and have a litter. I had never seen a cat give birth before, and I promised Eddie I'd find homes for the kittens, which, with much effort and cajoling, I did. I don't know what I'd been expecting from Olivia. I suppose I thought going into heat would be a discreet or hidden process, like a woman's menstruation. I wondered if I would even know if it was happening. In fact, I was shocked by both the suddenness and the intensity of it. Late one night, she got up from where she lay on the sitting room rug and headed with her usual mincing prowl towards the front door. She was all business, like when she detected a mouse or a bird in the vicinity, and I assumed that she had murder on her mind. But when she reached the door, she stopped, her back arched and her body elongated, tensile. Her rump rose slightly, and the most astonishing sound issued from her, a scalded, involuntary yowl. I had never witnessed anything like it, and what I felt for her was pity. She looked at the door, and then back at me, with such imperiousness that in my haste to do her bidding, I stumbled. The night was dark purple, and it swallowed her. Before bed, I brush and floss, attending with unusual care to the ritual. This morning I was at the dentist, and am feeling that renewed commitment to my teeth that a good dentist will inspire. My dentist is youngish, mid-30s. He has a diploma on his wall from Chapel Hill, and we talked about the American South, and he told me he loved Faulkner. It was my first time seeing him. I liked him. He wasn't, you know, dentist-y. He donned his latex gloves and flexed his fingers like he was about to crack a safe. Then he hooked his thumb under my jaw like a clamp and placed his index finger in my mouth and pressed down on something. A molar, maybe. Or just the back bumper of a gum. I was wearing those safety glasses, the ones that are always a little greasy. His finger was thick in my mouth, traversing the terrain, probing. I could feel the jelly of my tongue on it. I closed my eyes and tried not to mind about the pleasure. It seems like such a long time since anyone has touched me. I slept in the spare room the night I came home from Kevin's house. It was on the ground floor, below our bedroom. I left my bag on the table in the hall so that Eddie would know I was home, and I closed the door. When I heard him the next morning, getting ready for work, I didn't venture out, and was relieved that he didn't knock. That day, I tidied at the house. Then I went out front and pulled some weeds from the rockery, while Olivia lay curled under a shrub, sheltering from the sun. After a while, I gave up doing anything, and sat in the living room and tried to imagine what would happen when Eddie came home. I thought that within a marriage, I mean one's own marriage, there are currents that operate independently of us, and of which we seem remarkably ignorant. I didn't know what to expect from either of us. I wasn't sure I knew what I wanted. I thought of phoning my mother. During that last conversation I'd had with her, she had sensed, not for the first time in recent weeks, that something was wrong. She believed that it had to do with sex. She told me I needed to take care, that I shouldn't give Eddie cause to stray by becoming disinterested. And I had wondered, after hanging up, whether this thing with Collie was just a cheap solution to a commonplace problem, the anticlimax of settled domesticity. It was a question I had asked myself in the beginning of our affair, but that I felt I'd answered, and I was bothered by how the conversation had set me doubting again. We rarely talked about sex, my mother and I. From the age at which I'd first understood that I had been the product of a brief liaison, I'd had a discomfort with her sexuality that went, I think, beyond the unease people commonly feel about their parents' erotic lives, because I had no evidence of my parents' prehistory, no photos, for example, of the two of them together prior to my arrival, The one act I could be absolutely sure they had shared in assumed unwelcome prominence in my mind. I was thinking about all this that afternoon, about my mother and my father, and what the two of them had or hadn't meant to each other. I felt a sudden wave of empathy for my mother, for whatever hopes she'd brought with her into my father's bed, and I decided that I would call her. I wasn't going to tell her what was happening. I knew I couldn't bring myself to do that. I only wanted to hear her voice. I went upstairs to our bedroom, which I had entered only briefly and uneasily earlier that day. There was a phone on the bedside table, but instead of dialing, I sat down on the bed, which Eddie had made very neatly. It looked sealed, the way other people's beds do. The sense of trespass was so strong that I felt incited to go further. I wanted to rifle through Eddie's things. I felt the sort of intimacy with him I imagined a thief might feel with the stranger whose bedroom he was burgling. Very slowly, I lay back on the bed, as though unsure it would support my weight. It was about 4 in the afternoon. The sun was still warm through the big Velux window. There was a glass of water on the bedside table. Eddie's wedding ring was sitting on the window ledge. I didn't call my mother. I closed my eyes and lay there. The air from outside so clean and light on my skin, it was hard to believe there was anything amiss with the world. When finally I stood, I was unsteady, as though the house had tipped on its foundations. I was in the living room when Eddie came home. He set his briefcase on the floor, dropped into one of the armchairs, folded his hands in his lap, and looked at me. I asked if he wanted a drink, and he said a gin and tonic would be lovely. In the kitchen, I tried to gather myself. I mixed the drink and took a swallow, then brought it in, placed it carefully in front of him like some housewife from the 50s, and retreated to my chair. "You're not having anything?" he asked. I shook my head. I already regretted not making myself one, but I was trying to appear virtuous. He sipped at the drink and winced with pleasure, then set the glass back on the table. He looked ridiculously cool-headed, like someone in a film. "You were seen, you know." It seemed an odd thing to say, and the delivery so out of character. But maybe any opening would have been strange. "Yesterday?" The word sounded wrong. Was it only yesterday that I had been with Collie? "Not yesterday, no." "When?" I heard a meekness in my voice that perturbed me. I thought I shouldn't compound my misdeeds by groveling. I could be nervous, I could even shake, but I shouldn't cringe, and I shouldn't cry. With a flick of his hand, he dismissed the question, as though it were a subject we'd already covered. "Where?" I asked. He picked up his drink and said nothing. "You're not going to tell me? Does it matter?" Did it? I suppose it didn't. What mattered was that he wasn't going to tell me. I wondered, was he bluffing? "Why didn't you say something?" He let out a long, elaborate sigh, and his whole being seemed to soften with the exhalation. He looked over to where the sliding glass doors were open. "I was waiting for you to say something," he said, more gently now. And I almost believed him, and was flooded with remorse. It was very effective, whatever he was doing. Neither of us spoke. We were both staring out the door now, at the rockery, and the fence we'd been meaning to replace, and the firs that marked the border of our property. I wasn't sure why I'd come back last night, whether out of guilt or fear, or maybe out of love, or the end of love, which is perhaps more powerful in its way. "I'm so sorry," I said. Eddie gave that little upward tip of his head, the look of martyred acquiescence that covered just about everything. I had no idea whether he meant we should put all this behind us, or that we were past the point where apologies could make a difference. I waited for him to speak. When he did, he said, "We should eat." "I'm not hungry." "You have to eat," he said, as though I'd been refusing food for days. "I don't want to," I said. "You eat if you're hungry." We sat there, in a very focused silence, like two people stumped on a quiz show as the clock ticks. I felt there was something I should say, something specific, that this was the moment when I asked him whether he wanted me to leave. But that seemed more than we were ready for. Eventually, he said that I could do as I pleased, but that he needed some dinner, and he got up and went into the kitchen. I retreated to the spare room, where I remained, silent and immobile, as though, if I were quiet enough, he might forget that I existed. About an hour later, I heard him make a phone call, and when he hung up, he went out, without saying goodbye. I emerged from the spare room and walked into the hall, and then the sitting room, and then the kitchen. Everything looked different, in a way I couldn't put my finger on. Like when you've let people stay in your house while you're away. Collie phoned the next morning, around 11. He sounded distant but intimate, like we were two people touching base after a heist. He didn't ask how I was, he said. Did you tell him? I didn't tell him, I said. But he says he's known for a while. How, if you didn't tell him? I don't know, I said. All he'll say is that we were seen. The other day? No, sometime before. He won't tell me where or when or who told him. Collie scoffed. That's a bit perverse. Was it? To me, it seemed mean, but fair. But that was because I was still assuming that Eddie would tell me sooner or later, and we would go over all the gory details. It's not perverse, I said. It's fucked up, Collie said, sharper now. And I had the feeling his anger was not on my behalf, but was something between himself and Eddie. I didn't dare ask the obvious. What will become of us? It was clear Collie wasn't going to raise the subject, and I tried not to read too much into that. Maybe he felt I'd made a fool of him the other night, and he needed to get back at me. Or maybe he felt me readying to leave Eddie, and it frightened him. I didn't know whether to reassure him with proclamations of love, or, on the contrary, to play down the intensity of what I was feeling, to promise him I wasn't about to do anything rash. And so I bumbled along in the middle, and said nothing that made any sense at all. He promised to call again as soon as he could, and we hung up. I read once that to commit to love is to commit to love's diminishment, which means that commitment is less about optimism than it is about realism, accepting that love is doomed to become less of itself, and proceeding anyway, in the faith that one will be equal to the truth when it arrives. Eddie and I took a week in Lanzarote once. We were only a few months married, just emerging from the wedding and its afterglow, and entering a new phase, tranquil but eager, in which we lived in the anticipation of our shared future. We stayed in a big white hotel, facing the sea in Puerto del Carmen. In the mornings, the multi-tiered and clattering breakfast room smelled steamy, and not altogether fresh, a mix of meat and acrid coffee, and bodies not long from sleep. The hirsute men of Mittel Europa in their netted nylon tops, and their women, bulky and guttural. We spent the first couple of days at the beach, where rows of orange and blue umbrellas ran in perfectly straight lines. Underneath the umbrellas, the women rose darkly like mountain ranges, their tanned breasts slab-like or globular, or melting back into their bodies. I don't like going topless, even in bed. My breasts feel like cupboard doors left open, things vaguely in the way. But I was in awe of the breasts of these women, these 50-something women, some even older, born as Europe was rebuilding itself from ruin. I thought that if I were husband to breasts like that, I would be rendered speechless. I pictured those men, not skinny themselves, but of far less dramatic proportions than the women, carrying their great big wives through life, hauling them through the years like some kind of plunder they weren't sure what to do with, and I felt envy for them all, for the husbands and the wives, and their lack of shame, and all that flesh and history. On the third day, we hired a car to see the island. The roads were smooth and new, and there were not many people on them. We drove to the port at Orzola and boarded a dayboat to the smaller island of La Graciosa. We passed dull green cliffs that dropped like curtains into the sea. On La Graciosa, we bought picnic supplies and rented bikes and cycled the sand dirt track. As we crested a hill, the sea appeared below us, ice blue and alarming in his beauty. The sun was searingly hot. The powdery sand burned our feet as we galumphed towards the water in our flip-flops. There were a couple of dozen people there, but no one was swimming. At the shoreline, the beach sloped steeply. There were no shallows, just large waves breaking right where the beach began. We waded into our knees, and I felt a fierce pull, and Eddie grabbed my arm and said, "Don't go further." We splashed water on ourselves, then got out and found a shaded bench near the path, where we sat like children, side by side, eating our sandwiches and watching the waves. I felt a peculiar sort of loneliness, intense and perilous, and somehow related to Eddie, as though my very survival depended on his existence. But I had no way to communicate this, to make him understand it. Late that afternoon, driving from Orzola back to Puerto del Carmen, we passed through the volcano park. The day was cooling, the sun where we could no longer see it. Eddie pulled over on a high lay-by off the twisty mountain road, and we got out of the car. Spread before us in the distance was an expanse of black gravel, where succulents flowered violently. It looked like an exposed seabed, fabulous and otherworldly. Eddie got the binoculars from the car and handed them to me before looking himself. When he took his turn to scan the landscape, I watched him and was overcome with wonder. What I wanted more than anything just then was to live well by Eddie, by which I meant not only to love each other fully, but to become, because we were together, better people. I believed absolutely in the possibility, and felt an impatience to begin. It took about a week for me to understand that Collie had ended it. He didn't phone the following day, or the day after, or the day after that, and no letter arrived. I tried calling the payphone in the corridor outside his flat. Once, one of his neighbors answered, and said she'd slip a note under his door, but he never rang back. I became convinced that Collie would ring only if I left the house, and so I would go outside, pull the phone to the very end of its lead, and set it on the front step. Then I would attempt to do something, trim the hedge, or read, or sweep the path, all the while listening for the phone's trill, listening with a kind of suppressed hysteria that embarrasses me still. I thought of going on the train to Dublin. I tried to tell myself that I had the right, that Collie's silence left me no choice. I went over and over the things he'd said to me in our last conversation, as though I might divine from them some direction. And then I went over his silence, trying to read it for signs. In the end, I didn't go to Dublin. I think what stopped me was less the fear that Eddie might lock the door behind me than that Collie might not receive me in quite the manner I desired. I'm trying to be honest here. Finally, I drove to Kevin's house. He invited me in, but didn't offer me anything. I glanced around, trying to take in everything, as though I might see some clue to Collie's whereabouts or thoughts. The house was dark inside. It had lost its love nest aura and was simply depressing. Kevin, who only a week ago had seemed a benevolent extra in our love story, was now unshaven and shakier than ever. I asked him if he'd heard from Collie, and he said he hadn't, but I didn't believe him. I'd had the sense, when Collie and I were here, that Kevin was relishing his part in our drama, and now, in the aftermath, if that was what this was, he was relishing his new part, which was, what, to witness my suffering? To help keep me in the dark? The boys were closing ranks, and Kevin, I suspect, was not without sympathy for Eddie. "I just want to know he's okay," I said, as if it was all about Collie's well-being and nothing about my needs. "I'll give him a ring," Kevin said. "If I reach him, I'll tell him you called round." I tried to linger in the desperate hope that Collie might phone Kevin while I was there. But there was nothing else to say, and no reason for my hanging on there. And so I mumbled my goodbyes and got back into the car. It astonishes me now that I survived those days of unknowing. But people did, back then. There were times when you just didn't know where your loved ones were, when you couldn't reach them, and it didn't mean they were dead or had abandoned you. In the meantime, Eddie and I had conversations. We avoided mentioning Collie by name, but I felt exposed, utterly without privacy, at the thought that Eddie had been, in some sense, an audience to the affair. Whether out of weakness or faith or apathy, he had allowed it to go on. Oh, I don't mean allowed, as though he might otherwise have put me under lock and key. But he'd never said a word. He was impressive, the discipline that must have required. I hadn't gotten involved with Collie in order to test Eddie. It was enough trying to manage my own impulses and confusion without taking on the inner lives of others. But now that everything had screeched to a halt, I found Eddie's reaction alarming. What I had expected, that he would break down and tell me that he knew, and he would say to me, repeatedly, "How could you?" wasn't happening. He behaved instead as though it were all simply beneath him. Collie and I little more than naughty children who had embarrassed him in front of the other grown-ups. "Were you not even going to mention it?" I asked one evening. "What did you want me to say? What are you doing? I knew what you were doing. Didn't you want to know what was going to happen? Did you know what was going to happen?" I sighed and looked away from him. "That's not the point," I thought. Another time I said, "Didn't you want to know why?" We were standing in the kitchen. He didn't answer right away. He crossed his arms over his chest and stared blankly at a flayed, half-eaten chicken going coldly greasy atop the stove. The poor thing looked like we'd taken a hammer to it. This discussion had caught us unawares, triggered by a stray comment, and we hadn't steeled ourselves sufficiently. He was raw, and I was speaking rashly. Finally, he said, "In a way, I guess I didn't." I felt during those weeks that I knew nothing about my husband, because I did not know the most essential thing. Whether his steadfast refusal to corner and accuse me had been proof of his love, of his faith and his patience, or whether it meant that he was essentially indifferent to what I did, and that what mattered in the end was only that order should prevail. I believed what Eddie wanted was to forget that any of it had ever happened, when what I needed was an investigation, a verdict, a chance for expiation. As the days and weeks passed, and summer turned to autumn, we grew wearier and more estranged. Eddie's silence seemed to harden, and every day I tried to imagine my future and went blank with panic. One night, it was the last time we went out together socially, we attended a party in the flat-roofed hotel on the bridge. An old friend of Eddie's had returned from America to celebrate the 50th wedding anniversary of his parents, a couple who had treated Eddie, when he was growing up, like another son. Eddie insisted I didn't have to come, and I insisted that I wanted to. I think I was trying to stage civility between us, to put us in a situation where we had to act the part. I thought it would give us some relief from ourselves, and though the choice of occasion was a bit masochistic, a fact we acknowledged with the exchange of a brittle little smile, I was trying to feel, too, that I didn't have to hide. Lately I had avoided town as much as possible. There are no secrets in a small Irish town, not for long, and I knew there'd been gossip about us. The previous week I had met Eddie in town for a lift home, and as we walked from Wine Street to the car park on the quays, I realized that I was trudging behind him in the manner of a bad dog, and I gave myself a quick mental slap, "Look sharp," and straightened up and met the eyes of anyone we passed. What I remember of the party that evening is a low red sun, visible from only one corner of the room, through the picture window, but suffusing the whole room, briefly, with a rose-colored light. I remember feeling cut off from everyone, as though I were behind glass, and I remember a moment when Eddie caught my eye. He was talking to someone, and he offered me the tiniest, most intimate smile, and it was clear that for a split second he'd forgotten the state we were in. It was the old habitual smile, the old warmth. And then very quickly the smile vanished, and his eyes went blank, and it was as though he were looking right through me. We didn't stay long. I think we both felt the awfulness of being there. On the way home, I said that I was sorry I had gone, and he said that he hadn't forced me. And I said, "No, I mean, I'm sorry. I should have let you go alone. You might have enjoyed it more." "I don't think so," he said quickly, but then after a moment, "but you're right. You should have." In the end, we simply wore each other out. We agreed that it was over, and began the odious task of dismantling our marriage. The autumn saw us ambushed by nostalgia. I suspect it's not unusual. We were spent, and in our exhaustion, all the minor grievances fell away, and a kind of tenderness rolled in. The weather colluded. The heat, which by late August had had us itchy as caged beasts, finally receded. The tar on the roads hardened, the air thinned and grew cool, the earth itself seemed to mellow. In the evenings, the mountain tended towards a pale pinkish yellow. I had a brief fit of domesticity, as though something in me knew that this would be the last proper home I would have for a long time. I made jam from our own raspberries. I weeded the small front garden. I even sanded down a desk in the shed, something we'd bought one day at an antique shop in Wicklow, with the intention of restoring. It was like bad triage, letting the very worst thing happen while I busied myself with trivialities. We didn't cook much. Eddie worked late, out of what felt like courtesy. Then we'd meet for a bite down in the nearby village. Because the thought of facing each other for an entire evening at home cowed us. We were frightened and sad, and we no longer felt easy in our own home. After so long at odds with each other, it felt bizarrely that we were in this thing together, the shepherding through of our dissolution, and I had to work not to slide back into love with him. When I left him that October, I went to Dublin. My mother assumed I'd move back to America after the split, but I felt no desire to do that. It had been 7 years since I'd lived in that country, and already I'd lost the sense of it. I think I believed, too, that I didn't deserve such a clean getaway. Ireland felt sticky to me, like a room in a nightmare, a purgatory I had to earn my way out of. For several bleak months, I lived with an austerity that strikes me now as melodramatic, but which I know meant simply that I had no idea how to proceed. I rented a bedsit off Haddington Road. I sent my patchy CV to dozens of media outlets, and even some advertising firms. Eventually, I got an admin job for an architectural trade magazine housed in a laneway off Fenian Street. Within a few weeks, I was writing product features on wallpaper and timber and floor tiling. I felt moored by the work's banality and the ritual of 9 to 5. Occasionally, I joined my office mates for after-work drinks, but I always slipped away after the first or second round. I was determined not to lose control. I was trying to put some distance between myself and what had happened. All around me, I saw the city being gutted and rebuilt. There were cranes that looked like giant scissors, poised to slice the air, and others that stood straight and proud like T-squares, and others that dangled drunkenly. Buildings seemed to vanish overnight, and in their sudden absence I could not remember what had stood in the now empty spaces. I thought of a day when Eddie and I were heading out of the city, driving towards the N4, towards the setting sun. I had actually been with Collie that day. I was not long from his bed. And it seemed the streetscape was rising and falling around us as we went. From everywhere at once came the sound of pneumatic drills ripping through concrete, like the rumblings of war. I think we both felt it, the strangeness and the violence of it all. And neither of us said a word. The winter wore on. At the weekends, people left the city in droves for wherever they came from down the country, and Dublin felt desolate and empty. I'd buy a phone card and call my mother, working hard to sound upbeat, like I was on the cusp of a new life and knew exactly what I was doing. Every time we spoke, she said that if it was really over with Eddie, then why didn't I come home? And every time the question was harder to answer. I couldn't say to her, it would have embarrassed me, that I had some notion that there was a nobility in hanging on here, that going back to America would only compound my shame. I thought about Eddie all the time. I wondered how he spent his evenings, what he ate, how he felt when he went to bed at night. I thought of how we never have to face our own absences, the pain they cause, or whatever rushes in to fill the space. I tried not to think about Collie. Then I tried to think very hard about him, as though I could blow a hole right through him and he would disperse, like pollen, and drift away. It's a cool, low-skied April day. Sooty gray clouds have gathered in a rush, and now rain is threatening. Harry and I have just had a sandwich at a coffee shop on Baggett Street and are walking in Merrion Square. We stick to the tree-lined outer path, which even on the sunniest days has an air of brooding and damp. Harry has been talking about his marriage and its demise. The last time the subject came up, he said something about the traveling having taken its toll. He and his wife had met in Tanzania, and she had followed him to his next duty station. But once their daughter was born, his wife had wanted to make a home in Dublin. He stayed on in Tanzania. When I asked him why he hadn't moved back with his wife, he said, "It was the 80s. There weren't a lot of jobs in Dublin for someone like me. There weren't a lot of jobs full stop." Today he says, "I thought it would be for a year or two, and then I'd come back." But he delayed. His visits home became fraught. I felt in the way. I was convinced she'd fallen in love with someone else. Had she? I think she did for a time, but the damage was already done. I wonder if Harry wanted out, if he chose to absent himself until the marriage was no longer tenable. I want to ask him this. I want to ask why, if the marriage had died, he'd dragged it out like that. Finally, I say, "Was there someone else for you too?" Harry looks surprised. Till today we've talked around these things, and what I notice now in my hesitation is less a respect for his privacies than a reluctance to hear him speak longingly of someone else. My wife didn't want her life to be following me around while I lived my life. I didn't want that either. But neither of us had figured out how to live otherwise, and by the time we might have learned that, we had both done things that damaged the marriage and pushed us apart. I think of my mother, her broken engagement when she was young, the knowing what's not wanted without the knowledge of what is. I tell Harry about the end of my own marriage, the affair with Collie, how Eddie couldn't bring himself to talk about it, how I got angrier and angrier. "So how did it end?" Harry says. He asked me what I wanted to do, and I said I thought I should go. And he sort of acquiesced. "Was it what he wanted? For you to go?" I think for a moment. It was all so long ago, and I'm not sure I've ever known what Eddie wanted. "Yes and no, I think." "But you did. You wanted to go." "I must have," I say. Harry offers me a little smile. "I ended up feeling like he watched it go on," I say. "The affair, I mean. I hated that. I know this sounds crazy, but I felt abandoned." "Affairs have a rather terrifying momentum," Harry says wryly. "Sometimes it's wisest to just get out of the way." Harry is warming to Eddie, and I can hardly blame him. "Maybe," I say. I think of a moment from that summer, one I recall vividly, though nothing else of the evening has stayed with me. Eddie and I were drunk, and I remember his eyes on me, his look of alarm and confoundment, and my own inner state. I felt feral, like an addict, all stealth and unreason. He couldn't have reached me if he tried. "What happened to the other guy?" Harry asks. "Did you see him after that?" "I saw him once," I say. It was that winter, a few months after it ended. I had expected to run into Collie. The city is so small. But as is the way with such things, it didn't happen at any of the moments when I was braced for it. It was on Kildare Street, about 4 in the afternoon, on an unforgiving February day, leaden and grim, a clammy wind blowing. He was coming out of the National Library, and I was walking towards Nassau Street. He stopped when he saw me, shifted a canvas bag to the other shoulder, and greeted me with excessive surprise. I tried to bandy it back, We both glanced around then, furtive as spies, as though anyone cared any more what we got up to. The last time I'd seen him, he was standing in the bedroom doorway at Kevin's house. I had kissed him goodbye, weak with the want of him, and certain that, in that instant, he hated me. Not for going back to my husband, exactly. We hadn't made any promises to each other, nor had we ended anything, but for having pretended that this moment would never arrive, that we could go on playing house for as long as our hearts desired. And now here he was, standing in front of me as though none of that had ever happened, as though we hadn't lain in his bed under the open window, slick with our mingled sweat, as though a mere look from the other hadn't rendered us weak-kneed, saying something about Singh, about research he was doing at the library for an adaptation he was hoping to direct. When he asked what I was doing, I said that I was living here now, and he nodded and said he'd heard, but he didn't elaborate. I told him I'd come to Dublin for a job, as though it were some kind of career move. I didn't say that I was answering phones and writing about floor tiles. He nodded vaguely and looked me in the eye. That was the point at which, if one of us was going to say it, that we should talk sometime. It would have been said, but neither of us suggested it. Instead, we had a tricky little exchange in which we each managed to determine the direction the other was heading, and then said, "Oh, I'm going the other way," or some such thing. And then we said goodbye, and that was the end of that. We didn't touch, not a squeeze of the hand, or a kiss on the cheek, or a consolatory embrace. I was shaking when I walked away, my whole body, as though I had just witnessed a terrible accident. And yet there was a distant sense of anticlimax, too. Why is it that what we so often find on meeting someone we've loved seems not a residue or an afterimage, but a feeling more like foolishness? I'd stood there, close enough to touch him, and it seemed the moment should have been marked by the opening of the heavens, a clap of thunder. Anything but this small, vague embarrassment. Harry has stopped walking and is staring at one of the benches along the path. There is a woman asleep on the bench, and sitting up beside her, or sort of sitting up, is a man. He is leaning forward, and I think at first that he is actually falling, that he's going to tip headfirst onto the tarmac path and split his skull. But then I see how slowly he is moving, and I realize he's leaning over. He has his hand extended towards something, a rag, it looks like, lying atop a small canvas satchel on the ground. Down and down he goes, his advance barely perceptible. Midway to his goal, he lifts his head slightly and swivels it tentatively, dumbstruck, as though only having landed on this earth. I wonder if, in the state he's in, the world seems positively frenetic to him as it goes about its business, or if, instead, everything happens at the speed of treacle. Harry and I are engrossed in his progress, but before the man reaches the item, he actually falls asleep, gently and seamlessly, and rather impressively. He just freezes. I feel like clapping, as though we've been watching a piece of improv theater, and am immediately horrified by the impulse. Harry and I look away, in opposite directions, shamed, I guess, or sad. Harry told me once about Dublin in the early 80s, when heroin really came on the scene. He had friends in Dunleary, not far from where I'm staying now, who'd overdosed or died of AIDS. Sometimes Harry's stories about Ireland in the decades before I came here awaken in me a vicarious nostalgia that I can understand only as an aspect of my affection for him. He tips his head slightly, "Shall we?" And we continue along the path. A mist is settling in around us. The edges of things are growing furred. The square is nearly deserted. Harry is all in black beside me, from his brogues to his fedora. He looks, in the mist, like a Cold War movie spy. He looks handsome. The last time we had dinner, what I wanted more than anything was for Harry to invite me up to his sixth-floor apartment for a nightcap and let me lie down on his voluminous couch. He's told me he has a black leather couch, while some milky jazz poured from a 4-inch high speaker and a sheen of moonlight spread across the floorboards. I didn't suggest it. He says, when my father died, I felt a great need to put my life in order, to clarify things. I felt my mortality. Is that what I'm doing? I say, feeling my mortality. Nothing wrong with that, he says, smiling. We've got to feel it sometime. True, I say, but I don't know if I am doing that. I know that a certain pressure has leached from my grief. Its demands are easing. My mother's death is no longer an instant or a day, and the shock that reverberated out from that. It is who I am now, the bearer of her story, her life and the end of it. It has been 7 months and as many days since she died. Sometimes I forget, by which I mean not only that the thought comes to me that I must give her a call, but that I forget my own sadness, as though it is an item I have left the house without. I find myself in the midst of a moment of unaccountable delight. And then I remember that my mother is dead, and I think, why am I not felled by this? Why are we not all the time, crippled by grief? So did you clarify things? I ask. Harry stops, turns to me. Some things, he says. Others I just let go. The mist is growing denser, saturating. We shelter under a tree, which doesn't much help. Look, Harry says, the laburnum are coming into flower, and he gazes out over the square with satisfaction, as though he had ordered the spring himself, and here it was, arriving. Towards the end of my mother's life, and especially after Stan died, I used to feel, each time I left her, as though I'd failed her in some way. I looked at her with a kind of broken-heartedness, because it was never enough what I did. I could not save her from this life, or from death. I would go on living in her absence, and this, we all know, is a betrayal. But death is a betrayal, too. One has done it. One has crossed over, as though to the enemy's side. We were all in this together, and then suddenly, we weren't. The day she died, I was in a taxi coming back from Jomo Kenyatta. My mobile rang, and it was a woman who lived in my mother's building, her closest friend there, whose number my mother had recently insisted on giving me. We spoke briefly about when and how it had happened, and I said that I would call her when I got back to my house. I rang off, and when I looked up, I caught the taxi driver's eye in the rearview mirror. I held his gaze. My mouth was hanging open a little. For a moment, I felt terribly close to him. I felt he understood everything, and that I did, too, and that the two of us were keepers of a truth so shattering we didn't dare speak it. When I turned to the window, the world looked distant and inscrutable to me, as though I'd been decoupled from it. I spent 5 days in my mother's condo after her funeral. I was overcome with inertia and didn't want to leave. I sat on the sofa at night, where my mother and Stan had sat so many nights, where I had sat with them, the three of us in a row, the HD glaring out at us. And I wanted to sink into the everything and the nothing that was left. I kept the television off and ate my dinner in silence, and felt such a sense of aftermath I half expected to lift my head and see the living room strewn with wreckage. Instead, I saw a line of paired shoes through the bedroom door. I saw the framed photos fanned atop the wooden console and my mother's ancient desktop Dell. I saw the gewgaws on the side table, a collection of finger-high elephants. My mother used to say, in her later years, "Don't buy me anything. I'm trying to shed stuff." And she had. And so coolly. I could hardly fathom it. That at the end of a long life, the physical evidence for it should be so inadequate to its depth and breadth. I felt I should be able to open the book of my mother's life and glimpse multiple interiors in three dimensions. Vast tracts of earth and sea traversed. Eras, skies, 1,000 roads. Instead, there were a few dishes and wine glasses, some laundry, shampoos and creams I didn't know whether to use or discard. Hanging from the doorknob of my mother's walk-in closet was an ochre-colored canvas beach bag I had given her. I got it my first year in Nairobi, when I was on safari. And along the bottom were tiny animals, giraffes and zebras, and elephants and lions parading in a line. All the outlandish animals God had made, and in which my mother took such delight. I had a vague recollection of much fuss having been made over the bag. My mother was good at that sort of thing, expressing gratitude for even the humblest of gifts. And it was for the memory of that particular strain of generosity, that I took the bag and placed it on her bed, along with a few other items, random to the eyes of anyone but me, that I would bring with me when I left. In the spare bedroom, in a bag already packed, were my letters to her. One thing she had saved. They had petered out in the early 2000s when she got email. But in the last years of her life, every time I visited her, she took me into the walk-in closet and showed me where all her papers were and which box contained my letters. She said she wanted me to have them when she was gone. She made me promise not to throw them out. It was a strange thing to contemplate, coming back into possession of the 1,000 thoughts I had entrusted to her. I used to wonder if, when she died, I would keep my promise. But I have, partly out of superstition, and partly because one of the things I learned about my mother over the years was that she was usually right, and for reasons I often did not understand until long after the fact. There were lots of letters from the early days with Eddie, from our marriage, and from the end of our marriage, which had caused my mother much sadness. She had a way of intimating that I had been ungrateful, not just to Eddie, whom she adored, but to the gods, and was prone to reminding me, in so many words, that men like Eddie didn't grow on trees. I never told her what happened at the end, or why I left him. I deflected her questions until she stopped asking. She never knew that Collie existed. I thought that at least I could spare her the sordid details. But it was also true that I couldn't have borne her disappointment with me. There was a lot I did tell her, though. Rereading the letters, I was surprised by just how much. There was something touchingly naive about how honest I'd once been with her. All the fears and plans and daily routines I'd shared. An openness that, in later years, contracted into circumspection. Partly to protect her, but also because with age, I'd grown calculating about how I wanted her to think of me. And then there was that tone, common to letters generally, I think, of a rather cumbersome care, all the labored over details, the logistics and practicalities, the airport meeting points and copied out train times, the elaborate directions. There was a weight to it all then, in the time before electronic communication, a concreteness. In the time that passed between one dispatch and the next, I imagine a tremendous faith hanging in the air between us. And what astonishes me still is the trust we placed in the other's continued unwitnessed existence. During those days in my mother's condo, I thought often of Eddie. I wondered if I should tell him of her death. I wondered how much time need pass after a divorce before the sharing of such news goes from being a courtesy to being inappropriate or intrusive. There had been such affection between Eddie and my mother, and I used to feel, after we split, that I had deprived them of each other. We had not taken that trip in the autumn that he'd suggested. We hadn't driven my mother and Stan to the Keys. I tried to remember the last time Eddie and I had been in Florida together. I recalled the three of us. I don't know where Stan was that day. Going to a nature reserve, where we rode bikes along a canal on a path as smooth as marble. The day was clear and bright, and not too hot. It was winter, and alligators lolled fatly on the banks. To me, they were creatures of the most obvious menace, but they brought out a strange whimsy in my mother, who was, as she might have said herself, tickled by the sight of them. I was aware that I was flanked by the two people who mattered most to me in the world, and I felt, as I always do at such rare moments of contentment, shy and a little furtive in the face of my good luck, as though, if it were noticed, it might be taken from me. I let myself in the front door and inhale the air of the entryway, certain, now that I am moving out, that I can smell the sea again. On the landing are my half-packed cases and the boxes I had shipped from Nairobi. I am leaving the house in 2 days, I have taken an apartment just down the sea road in Dunleary, a place that would fit inside the kitchen of this house. I could have afforded more space if I'd gone elsewhere in the city, but I've grown attached to the view. From the fourth floor window of my new apartment, I'll be able to see the harbor, the tides moving in and out, the lights along the shore at Howth slithering like a whip into the sea. I wonder sometimes what my mother saw at the end, and whether it frightened her. What I imagine is her walking calmly and with resolve into the sea. This isn't altogether disconcerting. My mother adored the sea. Every time I visited, we would go on a boat ride, and she and Stan would lean on the rail, side by side, like children, pointing at the dolphins or the pelicans. They had embarked with such enthusiasm on the second act of their lives, and I am certain they felt repaid in kind. They had a habit of giving thanks for their good fortune. I used to wonder if Eddie and I would be as lucky. I tried to picture us old. I thought he would age well. He would be one of those large, rough-hewn men, hale and rugged and still desirable, solid as a house. I wanted to be there for that. I wanted to witness his life, to feel the heft of him beside me for the rest of our days. But then a kind of vertigo stole over me, like when you're standing at a height and looking out and down, thinking, I could do it. I could just jump. The call of the void, and all the life and death that is in your power. This morning I went to our old house, Eddie's and mine. I left Dublin after breakfast, and by noon was parked on the laneway running parallel to the mountain. I sat there eyeing the house like someone who'd been hired to tail whoever lived there. The new owners were already in situ. There was a car in the drive. The lawn was tended. There were potted plants on a front deck that had been added. On the path running along the side of the house was a child's three-wheeler. In spite of this evidence, the house looked deserted, eerily still, as though its inhabitants had fled, abruptly, in the face of some threat. I rolled down my window and stared and stared. Nothing emanated from it. Nothing arose in me. It was like being shown a photo of myself at a gathering that I couldn't recall having attended. The disparity between the richness of our days and the scratch marks they leave behind is so great, it's a wonder we trust so easily in their connection. I remembered meeting Eddie on the street that day in town shortly after I'd moved out. The shock of estrangement, which was itself an echo of intimacy. Now I could see us on the path that led to the front door, Eddie turning the key to let us in. I saw him standing in the kitchen, gazing out the back window the way he used to, the mountain pitiless and beautiful against every kind of sky. I thought of Eddie, and I felt self-conscious and uneasy, and full of remorse. But there was also something tender, a kind of compassion for whoever it was we'd once believed ourselves to be. I thought of our last summer together, how there are things we're unable to say even to ourselves, things we can only enact, as though we cannot believe they are what we really want until they become the only alternative we've left ourselves. I went to Kevin's house, too. I had trouble finding it. I had held in my memory something like a child's drawing of the peninsula, the curve of shoreline, a single laneway, the house perched proud and cheerful. But I found myself driving around on a web of roads that felt unfamiliar. Invisibility was bad. A heavy rain had turned the landscape blurred and viscous. Eventually, after many U-turns and much doubling back, I found the road. The skies cleared. In the sudden yellow sunshine, the house sprung up before me. I hadn't told Kevin I was coming. I didn't have a number for him. But country people are strange. You show up at their door after a long absence, and they greet you as though your arrival were the very thing they'd been expecting. Kevin had the front door open before I was even out of the car. He must have seen me passing slowly, and then reversing. We greeted each other shyly. We had never been close, but we had once colluded in something ruinous, and I felt with him the sort of intimacy I might feel with a doctor who'd given me news of a terrible illness. He'd grown skinny. The baby fat, what we all had back then and would never have thought of as such, was gone. His hair was grey and thinning. He led me into the sitting room, which was no longer catastrophic, but looked simply like the home of a middle-aged bachelor. Lived in, but thinly, as though it would only take an hour's labor to remove all trace of him. He asked me how I'd been. I wasn't sure where to begin, or what to leave out or include. I said that I was living in Dublin, that I was on a career break, sort of, that I'd been working abroad. I told him that my mother had died. He said that his mother had also died, and that his father was in a nursing home in town. He told me he'd had a lot of offers on his little house during the boom, and had been sorely tempted, but was glad he hadn't sold. He'd had to quit the building sites, he said. He had injured his shoulder in an accident and couldn't do heavy work. I pretended to look around the sitting room, then glanced over my shoulder towards the spare bedroom, which was behind me. Would you mind? Work away, he said, as though it were the most natural thing in the world, my turning up out of the blue like that to poke around his spare bedroom. If ever there was a case of a person going back and finding the room, the house, the yard, larger than remembered, I have not heard of it. The bedroom was as tiny as a jail cell. I recognized the wardrobe. It was the same one against which Kevin had propped those huge triangles of glass. Now there were two bicycle tires leaning on it, and a pump lying on the floor. Against the wall to the right of the door was the bed. I was tired, and I looked longingly at it, the way you do beds in furniture shops. And then I sat and stared straight ahead of me to where a window should have been. I recalled as clearly as I do any of the scenes from that house. Collie and me lying on the rumpled sheets and the sun streaming in through the large picture window opposite that looked out over the bedraggled front lawn, beyond which we could see, in the distance, the mountain looming behind my own house. But in reality, there was only a small sash window to the right, facing onto the gravel drive, and a bank of trees that separated Kevin's property from the neighbor's. I heard Kevin behind me. "You all right?" he said. I got up quickly, and we scanned the room as though for clues. I thought of asking him to leave me alone for a few more minutes, so I could get my fill of whatever it was I'd come for. Forgiveness, or consolation, or a rush of youth. "I'm fine," I said, and we turned and shuffled out. He invited me to stay for lunch. In the kitchen, he opened the fridge, which was clean, if mostly empty, and took out a bottle of mineral water. The floors were swept, I noticed. The stove top was scrubbed. The kitchen chairs stood uniformly at the table. "The place looks good," I said. "And me?" Kevin said. "Do I look good?" I turned to him. He busied himself finding a bottle opener for the water. "You do, actually." He pried the cap off and said, "I should hope so." He told me that by the end of that summer, he was having trouble remembering the most familiar things. The name of the woman in the local shop. The meaning of items he'd written on a grocery list. His mother's phone number. "It was like I had fucking Alzheimer's," he said. "So someone had dragged him to the hospital, and he dried out for 2 weeks with Librium, and then did 90 meetings in 90 days. After the first one, in a community center up on John Street, about a dozen people had come up to him and shook his hand and said, 'We thought you'd never get here,' as though he were delivering supplies to some desperate outpost. He got a head of lettuce and a cucumber from the fridge, and then went out back to where he'd planted a small garden, a raised bed in a plot of trimmed grass I didn't remember from before. The image I'd retained was of the world stopping at the edge of Kevin's patio wall. He picked scallions and dug up carrots and tossed everything together, then got 2 chipped plates out of the cupboard and some unmatched cutlery and a few slices of brown bread. We brought the whole lot outside and set it on a table made of a flat slab of rock. There were short stools of cracked vinyl that must have come from a pub, and we perched on them like little old ladies on a Sunday afternoon, sipping our fizzy water and eating our salad. 'Do you ever hear from him?' I asked. 'He's in London.' I knew that much. I saw it on the internet. He runs a small theater company there. His wife is a set designer. He went a bit off the rails, you know." I hadn't known, but it was easy to imagine. Collie was wired on a collision course with something. Even I could see it, as heedless as I was then. All the energy he didn't yet know how to harness. But he pulled it together. He's married. He's got 2 boys. He came out to the house a few months ago.
Really?
It shouldn't have surprised me that Collie still visited. He and Kevin had been friends since childhood. But I was startled to think of him here so recently.